Good afternoon, listeners. This is the weekly programme for senior citizens on Near FM 90.3. Austin won't be here today, but Paul Murray, I'll be taking over now for the next hour. So we have a gentleman who's had a lung transplant, and we would like to interview him and ask him about the situation at the moment and how he's getting on. So we go over now to Peter. Are you there, Peter?
Peter? Hello, Paul.
How are you,
yes.
Mate? Yeah, well,
I'm
glad to have you on.
Well.
So I'm on
Thanks
to you.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, it's nice to talk to you over the air. So I'd like to talk to you about your lung transplant. So if you could, good self, can tell me now where all this stuff started off first. You know, when did you get an inkling, or what was the problem? Or, you know, you tell it in your own words, if you can.
Okay, well, I never really had that much health problems, except 1982, I had an ulcer, but I had surgery for that, and that was the end of that. So, around 2015, I got a cough, and the cough wouldn't go away, and it was bothering me. It was a dry cough, and went to the doctor, and he organized to have an x-ray. In the local hospital, had the x-ray, and they came back and they said it was COPD.
Okay. Sounds scary.
And COPD. Now, I hadn't a clue what COPD is, but I looked it up in a book. So if I'm giving you a description about IPF or COPD, it's directly from the book, so you're not getting it mixed up. Of it, right?
Okay.
And it says here that COPD, or chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, is a lung disease characterized by chronic obstruction of lung airflow that interferes with normal breathing, and it's not fully reversible. The more familiar for COPD were chronic bronchitis and emphysema, but these are no longer used, but are now included within the COPD diagnosis. Okay, so that was 2015, and I was in Beaumont Hospital, and they were treating me very well, and I didn't think there was a problem. After a while, the cough didn't seem to get too bad. They tried different types of medications, and then 6 months were up, and I went, and everything was okay. And they said, we'll see you in 6 months' time. So 6 months' time, I was back again. And as I was leaving, they said, everything's okay, we'll see you in 6 months' time. And as I was going out, the doctor said, what's happening on the home scene? Anything? And I said, well, nothing. I said, but my brother died, I said, 3 weeks ago. And he said, what did he die of? I said, well, for years, I said, he smoked, whereas I didn't. And I said, he suffered from pneumonia through his life. And I said, he ended up in hospital with pneumonia, and he was in hospital for a couple of weeks, and he was discharged, and he was okay. But within a week or two, he was back in, and he couldn't breathe on his own. So he was put in the machine to help him breathe. And after 3 days, they switched the machine off, and he passed away. And I said to him, he had pneumonia, but I said, I heard somebody saying he had scarring on the lungs as well. And I said to him, what's scarring on the lungs? And he said to me, the team is meeting inside, Peter, and they'll be finished in a half an hour. He said, I guarantee if you stay here and wait, I'll get a team member to come out. He said, this might be life-changing for you.
Wow.
So I stayed, and the guy came out, and he listened to everything I told him, and he said, let me bring that to the team inside, and we'll get back to you. So I went home, and shortly after that, it was organised that I go for a biopsy in the Mater Hospital. So they sent me for a biopsy, and I hadn't a clue what a biopsy was. Right, but I got a a small document here that says for some patients it is necessary to take a small piece of lung tissue. A specialist will look at this tissue under a microscope to diagnose the problem. Taking a piece of lung tissue is called a surgical lung biopsy. Before the biopsy, medication to put you to sleep so that you do not feel any pain. So I was in hospital for a couple of days. The surgeon will insert a tube with a tiny camera into your chest so that the lung can be seen on a video monitor. A small piece of lung tissue will then be taken with a special device called a stapler, which cuts and seals the lung at the same time. And shortly after that, I was discharged from hospital and everything was okay.
Well, how did you feel, though? How did you feel, Peter? Were you scared? Were you puzzled?
No. It's amazing. It didn't strike me as, as a problem. I thought it was, just let me get over this and get back to work. It just didn't bother me,
Yeah.
I often look back at that and say, were you worried? I wasn't worried at all. I just thought Dr. McIlvenna's team in Beaumont Hospital were very good, and there was a doctor there called Dr. Sedgwick, and he was brilliant. And so I had to go back in early 2016 for the results. And the first thing he said to me was, did somebody come with you? And I said, no. He said, would you like to go home and get somebody, a family member? And I said, well, why would I want to do that? He said, well, we have some news for you that you mightn't like.
Oh,
I said, not at all. I said, I'm grand. Just tell me. And he said, would you like to sit down?
Oh, gee.
So I sat down. I didn't know what was going on. And he said, I have to tell you, the results of the biopsy weren't good.
Wow.
And he said, you have a terminal illness and you have maybe 2 to 2.5 years to live.
Oh, my God.
So I sat there and it was like as though suddenly I couldn't hear.
Yeah.
And it was like as though I was looking through a foggy window.
Yeah.
And I didn't know how to take on board what he just said, and I don't know how I got out of the hospital. And I remember saying, I can't go home and tell my wife this. I just can't.
Yes.
And I went to a friend and I said, what will I do? And the friend said to me, you have to go home because a problem halved is a problem shared. And I said, I can't throw that on her. I said, not after all these years. And they said, no, you've got to do that. So, I had 5 years of retirement over me. Things were looking up, I got back into motorbiking and I'd just taken on a bike that I was going to restore. First time in my life, I was going to restore a bike. And everything was looking rosy and I had to go home and give this information. And we got, but suddenly I was I wanted to put this happy disposition out there because I didn't want my wife to be worried. But I was in a dark place. And, all I could think of was, you remember that record the Travelling Wilburys had, and they had a song called The End of the Line?
Oh,
I said, God, I'm coming towards the terminus, of life. And so where do you go from there? So, I was in that dark hole, but I don't think I led on to anyone. I was in a dark hole. And, and maybe looking back, I should have communicated more to my wife. But my wife one day was looking at an active retirement magazine. And she saw an advertisement and it said, oh yeah, I was diagnosed with a thing called IPF. Okay.
And
the advertisement in this retirement magazine was a contact number for people who suffered from IPF. So I rang it, and it turned out that there was a support group for IPF patients in Whitefriars Street Church. And I was invited by this guy who had had IPF and had a transplant and was now very well. And his name, I'll just give his first name, his name was Paddy.
Yeah, and thank God for Paddy.
So he referred me to Whitefriars Street Church. Just to let you know, I looked up in this booklet again. So for people that have never heard, it's mostly people that are affected with IPF are mostly people in their retirement ages, like over 50, 55, and mostly men. That's the amazing thing. And IPF, it stands for idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis.
Yeah.
And the word idiopathic, when the cause of a disease is not known, is called idiopathic. So that's what idiopathic means. The cause of a disease is not known.
Wow.
And IPF, P is for pulmonary, and pulmonary is the medical term for lungs. This, it says here, this book will describe where the lungs are located, how they are, how they work. Well, we're not going to go into that.
And not today,
fibrosis,
please.
The last part of IPF.
Yeah.
This means tough or leathery tissue. It's scar tissue, which is formed in the lungs. And it says here we will describe how lungs with fibrosis are different from healthy lungs. Well, we're not going to go there, right? But
right.
That's what it is. Now, who's affected? How many people are affected by this?
Yeah.
The same booklet says, Paul,
yes,
that IPF is a rare disease.
Wow, yeah, yeah, okay.
Right, it's only about 14 to 43 people out of 100,000 people worldwide have IPF. Now, their figures going back to 2016, okay, might have slightly changed since that. It says IPF is much more common in older people, but can occur at a younger age. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, okay. I'm listening intently. Amazed.
Okay. A lot of people, you know, when they hear that I have IPF, the first thing they say, what the hell is that? And I just say, well, listen, your lungs are spongy, air-filled organs located on either side of your body. As we breathe air in through our nose and mouth, our lungs inflate like a balloon. Okay?
Okay.
The trachea, which goes down, the trachea, also called a windpipe, moves air into the lungs through a pair of tubes called bronchia. Each tube is called a bronchus. This means the bronchia branch into smaller bronchia and then into smaller tubes called bronchioles, which end in a very small air sac there called alveoli. Okay? The air we breathe is sometimes polluted. Our lungs work to remove dirt and germs from the air, and this helps us to stay healthy. But if we have scar tissue, it's going to cause a problem. Because it says here, along with IPF, idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis, does not expand as well as a healthy lung. The tough, leathery scar tissue in the lungs does not move easily. This makes it harder for a patient to breathe. So you're under pressure all the time to breathe. In addition, the leathery tissue located between the alveoli and blood vessels is thicker, making it harder for oxygen to enter the body and carbon dioxide to leave the body.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Excuse me just putting in there, but did he give you
that
there might have been some reason that you particularly got that, or was it something?
The only thing, as I say, it's unknown.
Oh.
Right? There's a lot of unknown factors.
Yeah.
Like some people would say, well, your brother had it, so you have it.
Yeah,
it doesn't necessarily run in families. Now, I've met someone whose three siblings died from it. But throughout the world, there's not enough figures throughout the world to say that is the cause of it. It doesn't run through the family.
Okay.
You know, there's so many things. A lot of people have said that it's diesel fumes are one of the biggest causes of air pollution, and that actually is a fact. But the other thing is, not only is diesel fumes a cause of air pollution, it's construction dust. The dust that comes from construction on roads, from building sites, it's all going up into the air that we breathe.
So you weren't you in the building business yourself?
I've been in the building business since I was 15 years of age. And I retired in 2010 when I was 60, yeah.
So I would imagine, though, that must have had contributed to your condition anyway.
Because I worked mostly in cement-based company. I was still in the vicinity. I was in an inspection and control.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay, I was in charge of the Olympics in the UK, so I was over there for 8 years before the Olympics started. So, like, everything there was concrete, you know? But even at that, Paul, is not the sole reason why people suffer from IPF.
Yeah.
They still haven't come to a direct conclusion. It's this or it's that. You know what I'm saying?
Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So,
carry on.
The hospital were great. They put on a drug called pirfenidone. Okay? Pirfenidone will not cure IPF. But what it will do is, it might give you an extra length of time. It'll prolong your life in some people. I have a friend, she's since deceased. She got 5 extra years. She got 7 years after she was diagnosed. And I have other people that I know got 3 years. I actually got 3 years instead of 2.5 years. I got an extra 6 months. You know?
Okay.
So I ended up on oxygen. I got an infection, and from the infection I ended up on oxygen. And you start on oxygen at a very small rate, and then I increased from, say, very small to medium to large to extra large. I actually ended up on liquid oxygen, right? And I had tanks of it, and I have to compliment the people that the health department, they used BOC, I don't mind saying this, fantastic people. They wired up the whole house for oxygen. So I had oxygen tubes all around the house, and I had oxygen tanks. I had to fill my own oxygen tanks. So it meant I was able to get out of the house, Paul.
Oh, yeah.
I was able to get on a bus with my wife and go over to Whitefriar Street Church and go to my meeting, and maybe afterwards come out and go and have a meal. And, you know, things like that.
Yeah, that's,
you know,
amazing. Amazing.
The oxygen made my life more normal.
And getting back slightly to the Whitefriar Street, did you actually just stumble on that? That wasn't recommended to you by any medical person?
No. My wife found in I was a member of the Active Retirement Group in Coolock.
Yeah, okay.
And they used to give us a magazine once a year called the Active Retirement Magazine. I used to play indoor bowls for the Active Retirement, okay? And the advertisement was in the Active Retirement magazine, and I rang it and got Paddy, and he recommended I go to Whitefriar Street. Now, when you go to ILFA, it's the Irish Lung L Fibrosis Association, right? And they were set up by a guy called Eddie Cassidy and his daughter, Nicola, okay, because their mother died from IPF. And they set that up. okay, as a support group for people who had IPF, somewhere that they could go. And the whole objective of that is, it's a social gathering of people that gather together for an hour and a half. And we sit around the table, we have a cup of coffee and a biscuit, and people talk about how they're feeling, how they're getting on. It's very sociable.
Yeah, and sounds good. Sounds great.
Great friendships came out of that.
Yeah.
And they organise great seminars and information days throughout the country. And there's groups all over the country. So we've gone to Cork, we've gone to Limerick, we've gone to the Midlands, you know, and we've participated in information days and met people. And there's people throughout Ireland that have IPF. And they're not all sad. They're all happy and they're getting on with their lives, but it's still a struggle.
Yeah.
So it's still a struggle. It's a struggle when somebody you know who is a real hero and dies, you know.
Yeah. It's amazing story, like, you know. And tell me about the actual transplant. You were waiting a while, I presume, to have that. Were you sort of still very hopeful you get it, or were you getting worried, or was
you? Well, you have to be accepted on the transplant list first.
Oh, I see. Yeah.
And one of the things that the Mater Hospital is brilliant is they see that you're healthy, insofar as other than IPF, that you're of a healthy disposition. They will put you forward to go for assessment for a to go on the transplant list. And I was put forward to go on the transplant list. And what you have to do is you have to go into hospital. So you're an inpatient for a couple of weeks, and every part of your body is tested. Every organ is tested. So I was in hospital for a couple of weeks. They didn't get all the tests done. I was discharged, and for the next 2 or 3 weeks, I had outpatient tests. In the matter, and after that, you have to be able to convince two consultants that you're okay, health wise, to go for the transplant.
Was it tough?
Yeah.
It tough waiting?
I had to be passed by two consultants.
Okay.
Which I was. I got the go ahead, and then I had to be passed by the head man in charge of the transplant program, and that's Dr. Egan, Professor Egan.
Yeah.
Okay, so he passed me, and the thing I had to do was I had to go and see a psychiatrist in the Mater Hospital, and I had to do some small tests, you know, like the sheets of paper with all sorts of figures on them. But I passed that, and then I was on the transplant list. So I was handed over to the hospital system. And one of the amazing things that happened is every Tuesday you get a phone call from the transplant coordinator's office. And they're a group of five women that are in charge of people that are on the transplant list. And they're my contact with the hospital. And fantastic people. What I call real heroes. Because, like, you have to... They're on one end of the phone and you're on the other end of the phone, and you realise time is getting short and you tend to be going closer to this dark spot again, and you find out every Tuesday you're waiting for that phone call, and the phone call comes, and the encouragement you get from those five women was unbelievable, second to none. I would say the encouragement I got transferred into a thing called hope. And I sort of realized that hope is another name for God, that somehow between all these people, God was in the mix. Now, I don't mean a religious God, I mean spiritually, you know.
Yeah.
And there was something absolutely unbelievable. One of the other things there, Paul, I wanted to say to you, when I was in hospital for the test to go on the transplant list, I saw a program on the BBC, and it was about an Irish girl who was living in a college, and she had cystic fibrosis, and she was waiting on a lung transplant, a double lung transplant, and she was called seven times to the hospital. She was called six times to the hospital, and she was sent home every time. And she got her transplant on the seventh call. Now, most people that get called for a transplant are called back about 3 to 4 times. They never get it the first time. And the reason for that is, if an organ becomes available, more than one person is brought in. There has to be one or two, because you have to be compatible to so many things. Bloods must be compatible, tissue must be compatible, and lots of other things. And the final say is made by the surgeons. Yeah. I got a phone call on the Tuesday morning, the normal phone call, and the week before this happened, and they said, Peter, we realise, you know, things are not going too well, and we're going to bring you into hospital for observation, because I knew myself I was going downhill. I was brought into hospital for 4 days, because at that stage, since Christmas, this was the first week in April 2019, and I hadn't been able to eat much. Even the very sight of the fridge made me nauseous. The sight of the fridge, no matter what food my wife brought, it was so hard to consume it. And they brought me in and they put me on steroids to get me to eat. And the amazing thing was, when they brought the food in with the steroids, I nearly yet the arm off the person that was bringing the food in. You know,
oh, that good, yeah.
I got my appetite back.
Well, that's amazing, yeah. Amazing, yeah.
Yeah. So I was discharged after 4 days.
Wow.
And I was at home. That was the weekend. That was the weekend that Tiger Woods was playing in the Masters in Augusta.
Oh, good.
And I remember Tiger Woods coming up the 18th fairway. And I was saying, my God, Tiger Woods hasn't won a tournament in 9 years because of his back problems. I said, if he could come back, could I come back from this?
Yeah. So you owe a lot to Tiger Woods, so is that what you're trying to tell me?
Well, Tiger Woods and my mother died in 2001.
Yeah.
And I looked after her for a couple of years before she died. I was her carer and my wife. And my mother said to me on our dying bed, she said, if anything ever happens to you, I want you to call out my name. Because she said, I'm going to open doors for you.
Wow, yeah.
And that day that Tiger Woods was coming down the fairway, you know, I knew I was going downhill. And I suddenly thought of what my mother said. Never, ever, ever thought of those words before. But I suddenly thought, she said, I want you to call out what you want, and yeah, I'll open doors for you. And I said, ma'am, if you're going to open the door, you better do it now. Right? And at 8 o'clock that night, the next night, that was the Monday night,
yeah,
when Tiger Woods won. The next night at 8 o'clock, the phone rang, and it was the transplant coordinator's office, and she said to me, Peter, how are you? And I said, you normally ring at 11 o'clock in the morning. She said, we did, we rang you this morning. And she said, you weren't well. And she said, we're ringing now, there's a very, very slight chance of a transplant. And she said, there'll be an ambulance out in half an hour. And you see, at that stage, we were always told by the hospital to have a bag packed.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You know, it's like that song, oh, my bags are packed, I'm on my way.
Oh.
You know? And so we were in the hospital before 9, and we had to, they had to prep me and do all sorts of things, you know? I remember they took every blade of hair off me, put a sheet on the bed, This guy came in with a razor. When I got up off the sheet, there was an imprint of a gorilla on the sheet. So, and then I had to have a shower and all sorts of things like that, and shave and all. And I didn't know till the next morning, because they said the other guy that was in, he's been in hospital as an inpatient since Christmas. and they said he really badly needs this lung. And it turned out that both of us were compatible. But it looked to me as though one of us was going to get sent home, and the other guy seemed to need it more than me. And I more or less said to myself, I can see myself going home the same route that we came in the ambulance, you know. And I suddenly thought of what Sharon and Willie, they were the ambulance crew. And you know what they said to me when I got in the ambulance?
Yeah, come on.
Is this your first call in? I said, yeah. I said, it's my first call. So I said, because it's my first call, you'll be bringing me home, because nobody gets a transplant after the first call. And you know what Sharon says to me?
Go on.
She said to me, you don't know what you're talking about. She said, we're the lucky crew. I said, what do you mean by that? She said, any patient we've ever brought in for a transplant, for a decision, they always get their transplant. So she said, you're with the lucky team tonight, you're going to get your transplant. And I said, no, this is my first call. And that morning I was saying, you know, like at 6:30, they went down to find out what the consultant, what decision they'd made. And the transplant coordinator, Zita was her name, fantastic woman, a real hero. She should get a medal. She stayed with my wife, encouraging my wife all that night. And she came back up and she said, you'll never guess. She said, you need a left lung, Peter. Because once you're over 50, you're only entitled to one lung, you know, because they reckon at that age, one lung's enough to get you to maybe 90, you know.
Oh, 90, and yeah, okay.
Said, yeah, and she said, the other man needs a right lung. If he needed a left lung, he was going to get it.
Ah, gee.
But he needed a right lung, and I needed a left lung, and both of us got a lung.
Oh, wasn't that great? What a story.
And you know what I said?
Come on, tell me.
I said this to myself. I said, thanks, Ma.
Yeah, well, isn't that a lovely story?
I said, thanks, Ma. Now, when I was in hospital, Peter, or Paul, when I was in hospital, I came to the conclusion I hadn't got a clue. I should have brought in a learner sticker that you see on cars and stuck it on me back. I had to learn to be a patient because I hadn't a clue how to be a patient. The people in there, the carers, the nurses, the consultants were absolutely fantastic, because when you're in that situation and you've had a transplant, you cannot do anything for yourself. Anything. You just cannot do. Every bodily function, you have to be helped. And I had to put everything. If I was ashamed of anything in my life, I had to put all those feelings to one side and just take it. And the people there were absolutely magnificent. Wait till I tell you, Paul.
Come on, tell me, yes, go on.
The people that came into my room to clean the room, they were people from all over the world, different nationality. Most of them, when I got talking to them, they were coming, they were Irish citizens now. And they didn't have great English, but you know what they had?
Yeah, come on.
They had encouragement, and they had a smile on their face that was unbelievable, right? There was one woman that used to bring in my meals every day. She was from Africa. She never said very much. Her name was Veronica. And she brought the sunshine into that room.
No, isn't that lovely? Lovely, lovely, Tori. Yeah, it's good that all the people together are helping out, yes. Anyway, you keep going. Don't get too bogged down on these other ladies from Africa. Come on, tell me what happened next.
I'm actually getting emotional just hearing. No, she was a fantastic person, right? Just, I often said, now I know why the Beatles made that song, Here Comes the Sun. It was for her, because that's what she did. She brought sunshine without words into the room, you know.
Okay.
Absolutely lovely person, you know. And there was another nurse in the...
Don't tell me about too many nurses now. We haven't got time.
No. This was a male nurse.
Oh,
it was from Manila.
Yes.
Right? the pain got so bad for me one night.
Yes.
I couldn't sleep. And this nurse sat up with me all night. And his name is Nelson.
Yeah.
He was a fantastic nurse. Absolutely brilliant. And I'm just going to name one other person. And that was Claire from the High Dependency. She was the nurse trainer. I don't know her exact title as regards a nurse. But for such a young person, she was brilliant, right? Absolutely brilliant. So the other thing was, and I'm coming very near the end, the pharmacist came into my room a couple of times before I left, and the dietitian. Okay?
Yes, come
and,
on.
And the pharmacist came in, and the pharmacist, I wrote this down, right? So I wouldn't miss it out.
Good man.
Right,
good
the pharmacist,
man.
The pharmacist visits the patient, the transplant recipient, while still in hospital to explain what medicines I'm on, their side effects, what to expect, and to reduce worry in the diary, how to record my daily diary, my daily medication diary, and how to identify the medications that I'm on by package, by the date stamp on the file, etc. I have to tick off the name. I have to write out in my diary every day. I have to write out the name of the medication. I have to write out how much, what time. Like, say, I take tablets at 7 a.m., 10 a.m., 2 p.m., 7 p.m., and 10 p.m. I have to record the dose, and I have to record how many I've taken. And I have to tick that off every day. And when I go in to see my consultant in the hospital on the 7th floor, they inspect your diary to make sure that you're getting everything. The other thing I had to do was I had to form a good relationship with my pharmacy. So
okay.
They had to know that I was a transplant recipient. Because I'm on two lots of medication. I get my normal prescription from the hospital, but I have a secure security prescription. And these are all, I'm on three immune suppressants. And they're on a special prescription. So the pharmacy has to know exactly what I get. And so they're kept in the medical box that the hospital recommend that you get. And you have to bring that box with all the medications into it when you visit the consultant. And she inspects the box, and she inspects your diary that you're keeping it right. Because it's very important that with generic medicines nowadays, sometimes the wrapping might be different. And if it is, and I don't understand it, I have to ring the transplant specialist nurse and explain what the packaging looks like, what's actually in the box, and I have to get a feedback from her whether to take them or not.
Well, when did you get the I'm interrupting you, but I have to do because time is running out. When did you get the word that the operation or whatever you call it had been successful?
Well, we still don't know whether it's successful because it's monitored every so often. I have blood tests every couple of weeks, and everything is monitored by the blood test. Like, say, for instance, I had a blood test 2 weeks ago.
Yes, yes.
And within a day, you get a phone call or you get a text from the hospital. If you get a phone call, that means that there's a problem. If you get a text, the text usually says your blood tests were okay, stay on your medication, no problems, and you needn't answer this text.
Okay.
But if you get a phone call, the phone call is usually to say that the blood test has detected a problem. Okay? And they're going to balance, like you might one medication might be increased and the other one might be reduced. So it's juggling all the time. Since I had my transplant in April, it was Easter week 2019, I've had heart problems for 6 months. I had kidney problems and I had skin cancer problems. All of those have been resolved. I had day surgery for the skin cancer, which turned out to be a basal cell melanoma, which was okay. And one day I went into the cardiac department and they said, Mr. Gallagher, you no longer have heart problems. And the kidney problems have resolved themselves as well. Though I was in last week, I had a scan and I had a special dye put into my kidneys. Kidneys are still a little bit, you know, so you don't know.
Okay.
All the time.
So you're still in the battle zone, so to speak.
I'm still in the system.
Yeah, okay.
I'm still in the system.
So
every day is just utopia because I'm alive.
Well, I was going to say, Daddy, I want to finish off soon. That what was the best effect for you? I presume you didn't get back to doing the bike.
3 weeks ago, last Thursday.
Yes.
I got the bike started. The bike is going.
It's going. You weren't done it though.
It's going. No. Okay. I've given my wife an understanding that I wouldn't drive it again.
Okay.
I'm driving bikes since I was 16, right?
Right.
And
yeah.
I've learned
a biker.
Over the years, I've bounced along the roads of North County, Dublin, and Ireland from falling off bikes. And I'm not able to bounce as well as I used to.
Yeah, well,
okay.
I know.
That bike, why do I tell you? Prior to my transplant, I had no energy whatsoever.
Yeah.
I had run out of energy. And I only had enough energy to do. I used to bring a duvet into the garage and lay it down beside the bike. And I only had enough energy to spend 5 minutes on the bike per day.
Ah, gee. Now, that's like, I don't know, the bikers all over Dublin are listening into this, and I'm sure there's tears in their eyes. That's the, you know, you're lying down on the duvet, fixing the bike.
Yeah.
Well,
I tell you.
I can't tell you much more now because we're running out of time, Peter, you know.
That bike is a 1966 Honda Bentley type.
Okay, yeah. Oh, well,
1966.
Well, all I can say is, Peter, thanks for coming in. It's really a great story. A happy story. And, you know, you're a great man. The biker among all bikers, you know.
Well, wait, can I just say one thing, Paul?
Yeah, only one thing. We're nearly there.
Just
go ahead.
One more thing. Sometimes the HSE get very bad press.
Yes.
Okay, but if you go in to any of the departments where there's people who are chronically sick, there's heroes in there. Absolute heroes.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay?
Well, you're a hero absolute yourself hero. Now, Peter, you know, because what you went through was amazing, and you still have...
Not at all. No,
yeah.
Wait till I tell you.
Okay, we have a couple...
I have another hero here, and that's my wife.
Oh, yeah.
And my sons and my daughters and their spouses. Only for them. At the end of the day, it doesn't matter about money, cars, houses, motorbikes, anything.
Okay.
If you haven't got your family and your wife and your health, you're nothing.
Okay. A great way to
nothing
finish, Peter.
Matters.
Okay. Thanks very much for coming on. Hopefully we'll have you back on soon again. Maybe in another category.
Okay.
Thanks for coming on, Peter. Okay. Bye now.
Bye-bye.
Take care.
Bye.
Well, there you are, folks. That's the story of Peter and the lung transplant. And didn't he tell it so well? Maybe too well at times. But it just goes to show the endurance of that man is just amazing. And you can imagine going under all that stuff. And the fact that he got the lung and the other guy got the other lung, I thought that was a beautiful end to his story. Seeking the lung transplant anyway. So to celebrate it at the moment, we'll have a We have a piece of music. Maybe Buddy Holly, Joe, will be nice just to cheer us up, or maybe celebrate it for a while. Okay.